This is current Neil Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air, and I am Jim Grant, and with me, as always, is the great Deputy Editor of Grant's, Evan Lorenz, and Henry French at the control panel. And with us today is Dan Zorn, who is the Chief Executive Officer and the Chief Investment Officer of a firm that does nothing except look for opportunities in unconstrained searches for opportunities in the world, having to do principally with special situations and in credit. And Dan is a man of some educational parts. He's a Penn Fellow, University of Pennsylvania, engineering student, computer science, and got an MBA from Harvard. And he has once served on the board of trustees of Barnard College of Columbia University and trustee of the Brookings Institution, a senior trustee, mind you. So he is a formidable being. And Dan, welcome. Welcome to Current Yield. I have a question I've been dying to ask you since your fine appearance at a March event that we sponsored concerning private credit. Well, they're not unrelated.
And that's
here,
true.
And here, Dan, is the money quote. I can assure you, we quote you as saying, that there is a tsunami of terrible, terrible businesses and assets that need to be rationalized. And the total addressable market, if you think of it this way, is bigger than it's ever been and growing. Period, close quote. Does this presuppose the existence of an everything bubble and with the implication there is an everything comeuppance with the suitably immense opportunities awaiting us?
It does. It does, Jim. Ultimately, there is no doubt about the everything bubble because QE2 starting in 2012 made it so. The question then is, will there be the comeuppance, and in what time frame will that comeuppance occur? On the first question, I would argue that there has to be, because when you engage in the level of fiscal profligacy that most of the world's significant governments have done since 2020, and effectively incinerate your fiat currency, your ability to reduce the compensation you pay investors to expose themselves to your currency is materially reduced. And therefore, if you are Jerome Powell or Christine Lagarde or others, you simply cannot lower that price materially. Therefore, you effectively raise the cost of capital around the world, which is very damaging to those owning assets that were accumulated during that very everything bubble that many of those same people created through QE2. And so in the absence of, for instance, a sudden, a tremendous belt tightening whereby, for instance, the United States government decides that, you know, only a quarter of its 200 global military bases are necessary, that it doesn't have to be the policeman of the world, that it considers Social Security age to be life expectancy plus three, like it was when the program was started, there is no other way to go. And so then the question is, over what time frame does that occur? And for that answer, I think you have to look to what's in the best interest of the people who make those decisions, which are the folks in the government bureaucrats and the monetary authorities. And what's in their best interest is, in the first case, is to mortgage the future to buy votes today. And what's in the second case is to push the problem into the hands of the next person who occupies their seat. And so that means a managed, slow-rolling process of bubble reducing that could take several years and will feature a combination of elevated rates.
Dan, bring it back to people who are pushing off the problems into the future. According to Lincoln International, the average U.S. private equity-backed company covered its fixed charges 1.07 times in the fourth quarter of 2023. At the same time, though, economic growth has been pretty good in the first quarter. How healthy is the average PE-sponsored company today, or how healthy are PE companies in aggregate?
Well, I think you have to differentiate the health of a company or the asset and the health of its balance sheet. And interestingly, the enterprises that you would think would have the greatest appeal to private equity which are low capital use, high cash flow conversion, strong five forces advantage, et cetera. Things like enterprise software, healthcare services, other types of business services. Many times they're great businesses. And given the five forces strength that they have, even in an inflationary environment, their ability to maintain margins is at least reasonable and potentially even greater, given the fact that they can effectively raise prices along with their increases in costs. The issue is more of the fact that they've been grossly overcapitalized. And when ultimately the post-tax unlevered free cash flow yield starts of any enterprise or asset starts to compress toward risk-free, ultimately, you know, the chairs on the deck of the company's ship, so to speak, have to move around, typically toward creditors and away from equity owners. And so that, I think, is really that much greater problem versus underlying damage in the enterprises.
And getting back to balance sheets, Moody's just had a report out today that said 40% of the companies that defaulted last year, and we're talking private equity sponsored companies, were repeat offenders, i.e. they had already defaulted once, their lenders had granted them a reduction in debt, an extension of maturities, but they still defaulted again.
Yeah.
What's driving this? Why isn't one like balance sheet restructuring enough to put these companies back on the straight and narrow? Or how much does debt need to be written down in kind of these companies for them to become good enterprises again?
Sure. Well, so ultimately, the issue is that, again, as Charlie Munger used to say, show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome, right? And so the fundamental purpose of what are now referred to as liability management exercises among creditors and private equity sponsors is basically the avoidance of the recognition of loss of a mark. And so, as you can imagine, when that's your goal, the idea is, okay, well, you know, I have, I had a 5x levered company and I'm the creditor. Cash flow has been reduced in half. I have a 10x cash flow loan. It can barely service. It's already subsidized coupon. What I should do proactively is actually fit the debt to what is able to be serviced appropriately. And then as a creditor, take the remainder of the enterprise or the value and put it in my pocket and own 100% on a go-forward basis. But that would require effectively recognizing that my par loan is worth a lot less than par. And so instead, what I do is I say, hey, private equity sponsor, you nominally continue to own this. I'm going to stretch out the 10x levered loan that you have. And maybe I'll take a little bit off the top. But I'm going to get a greater coupon and I'll take some warrants just in case things go spectacularly well so that I can go back to my valuation counterparties and say, well, look, I have a greater coupon and I have some warrants now, so it must still be worth par. And ultimately, we exit bankruptcy or a restructuring and out of bankruptcy or out of court restructuring where the enterprise has still too much debt. It's facing fundamental issues with which it cannot contend, and ultimately it goes and, as they say, files chapter 22 or 33. And so that's what you're going to continue to see.
To what degree is this because of a capacity issue? And I don't mean balancing capacity. A tremendous amount of money has been raised in private debt funds, CLOs, whatever, but because defaults have been so low over the last decade, not a lot of lenders have actually hired workout teams. And in order to restructure a balance sheet and take a control position as a lender, it's very people intensive. To what degree are these kind of subpar and kind of can-kicking exercises because they just don't have the people to do this?
Well, I think that is, it is the case that they don't have people to do this. And we've actually have a substantial amount of resources around this capability, so much so that we actually do this for third-party private equity and private credit managers. But I don't think that's the primary driver. You know, certainly the number of folks who are capable of doing these things has been reduced over time, particularly relative to the amount of that number of highly leveraged enterprises and assets there are, just because it's been a while since, you know, risk was appropriately priced. And so a lot of people have been retired and gone off to other areas, et cetera. But ultimately, a lot of these managers are really, really doing well at the management company level. And they could easily afford to have these resources if they had so chosen to do so. But ultimately, what they really want to do is keep those loans at par for as long as possible. And I believe that is the primary driver.
Dan, you have been a trustee at educational institutions and endowments, and no doubt have a lot of experience with investment committees. How do you read the vulnerability of American higher education to private equity, which has been, until fairly recently, the flavor of the month, the season, and the cycle for endowment investing?
There's an enormous amount of exposure. I would say if you looked at how a number of large-scale institutional investors allocated, and I would say, generally speaking, particularly among endowments, what you saw was a conflation of asset type and, we'll call it, capital structure risk, right? And by that, I mean that you might say I have diversification because I have long-short equity, and I have long equity, and I have real estate, and I have corporate private equity, et cetera. But in many of those underlying buckets of supposedly more diverse allocation, a substantial amount of equity risk was being taken. And so if I'm at the bottom of the capital structure in public equities, in real estate, in private companies, et cetera, I might have different nominal exposures, but I have a giant amount of effectively residual capital structure risk that's going to be highly correlated to the overall environment. And so in the end, that's why you saw that at the end of June 2021, there were a whole series of self-congratulatory press releases in the endowment community regarding their spectacular genius in registering 40, 50 plus percent returns. You've seen less of that lately, as you can imagine. And, you know, if you are able to go up 40 or 50 or 60% in a year, it means you're able to go down that level. And so I think there's a lot of exposure, a lot of remaining exposure. And I think over time, what we're going to see is the huge explosion in secondary LP activity will begin to expose some of that in a way that people haven't seen before, whereby, for instance, they will have LP units at marked at NAV that are trading at 60% of NAV.
Dan, you sound as if you're bearish, which at Grant's Interest Rate Observer, I assure you, is no sin. But but given that outlook, how do you pace yourself in seizing opportunities of the moment with perhaps the expectation that the opportunities of the moment plus one or plus two will be even greater? And, you know, it's been so long since the world has seen anything resembling a sustained liquidation, sustained bear market. Is not the risk of getting invested in special situations or workouts or restructurings, is not the risk getting too much too soon?
Well, I think if you are exposed to the moral hazard created by having very narrow-banded capital, that can be a material risk, because in all of these different areas, there is only episodic appeal, so to speak, right? They always cycle, you know, such that great returns are available, people see it, a lot more capital comes in, the excess return gets effectively competed away, there's an overhang, it blows up, and so forth, on and on and on. The great part about being able to move across any permutation of industry, product, geography is that the frequency and wavelength with which each of those permutations are propelling are frequently uncorrelated with one another. And so when we are active, we're active in things where the implosion has happened on the distress side, right? On the on what we call the right side of the barbell. And that implosion has materially occurred in things like growth in the LP universe, in CRE, commercial real estate, and is kind of bubbling up in corporate enterprises and coming along in structure. And we don't, when it's still early, you know, we're not involved. So as an example, in structured finance, there's tremendous issues that have been exposed through ever-increasing delinquency numbers and underlying collateral. But the opportunity, the owners of that risk haven't been willing to sell it yet. so we don't care. But on the other side, there are plenty of areas where that's already begun to occur and we're all over it. And furthermore, in a number of those instances, on the left side of the barbell, in new issue opportunities, in asset-based lending, energy lending, commercial real estate lending, and many others, that really saw poor return per unit of risk available for many years post the GFC, those have come back around again and become compelling as well in kind of new clean opportunities with much more rational capital structures.
Yeah. Dan, for those listeners who do not have 100 people across 6 global offices operating in over 20 countries looking for workout opportunities and specialists, how might they proceed in positioning themselves to take advantage of some of these kind of fearsome but still appealing opportunities that may be unfolding now?
Well, it isn't the easiest thing, I would say. It's hard to kind of stay on top of it, as you point out. In addition to, actually, we have almost 175 people, and we also have 50 affiliated joint venture partnerships and several hundred more. So we have a lot of people kind of boiling the ocean to recognize where the optimized return per unit of risk lies. I would say that, with my allocator hat on certain of the boards with which I'm involved, we try to find people, or I try to advocate for folks who have long numbers of years of experience combined with less capital than they're capable of handling, which happens as new interesting people form new companies, new firms to kind of go at these opportunities, and who have investment mandates that are flexible enough not to subject themselves or their investors to moral hazard. And so, there are many of the folks that you frequently cover in your publication are like that. If you think about the way Buffett operates and Munger, of course, where there are public entities that they manage, or brilliant in owner operators like a John Malone. There are many public stocks that are effectively funds through which very smart, thoughtful allocators of capital operate. IAC would be another one, Barry Diller and his colleagues. And then if you are an institution, there are certainly at an institutional level, global firms that, again, are free to kind of go where things do make sense and avoid where they don't, that you can choose from, where people are laser focused on trying to avoid being kind of on the wrong side of the trade, so to speak.
Dan, you said you expect a series of kind of like rolling implosions because of the everything bubble. And you pointed out that commercial real estate was one of the earlier assets to actually get hit. Jonathan Gray, a few weeks ago, he's the number 2 guy at Blackstone, said that prices and negativity have been priced into commercial real estate. And notwithstanding the fact that headlines are still scary, I mean, Vornado just the other day said that instead of building a new office building in the former place of the Hotel Pennsylvania Manhattan, it might build a tennis court or 150-foot tall billboard. Has commercial real estate sold off to a point where there is value there and it's a good time to get in? Or do you still see bad things for the asset class?
The answer is yes. It's a good example of the barbell, which is, as an example, on the left side of the barbell, there are assets with debt coming due where you can buy them or finance them at levels that are much more reflective of kind of a long-term higher rate, higher cap rate reality. That said, there are a huge number of assets that where the marks haven't been taken, for instance, within hundreds of billions of dollars of collateral within the banks that have yet to be effectively monetized, because ultimately the banks need to aggregate more reserves that will allow them to then take losses while still kind of managing their earnings. And so on both sides of the barbell, there's a lot to do. But to suggest that kind of all is well and easy is just not realistic. But definitely there are new things to do. If you have an asset and you need to sell it today, it's going to be at a different price. If you need to finance it today, it's going to be at a different price. The issue is there's a huge number of assets that still haven't kind of come out to market.
Dan, is the U.S. Treasury truly a AAA or a near AAA credit?
It's a tough question. I think, Jim, at some point, is it the least worst? That continues to be the bet. It's the least worst quote unquote risk-free investment out there.
You know, I asked that in reference to the anomalous tightness of corporate credit spreads against treasuries. And one way of reading that is that people simply people are mistaken about the cycle and that there's a recession looming and that these spreads will widen. Another way of looking at it is perhaps these investment grade companies are actually, you know, generate positive free cash flow, unlike a certain government we all pay taxes to.
Well, I think there are several data points you can look at. It has certainly been noted in the marketplace that, for instance, the rising price of gold reflects international demand away from the U.S. government. I think there are certainly folks that we've spoken to who are familiar with large-scale global sovereigns that have said that there is tremendous resistance to exposing themselves to kind of longer than five-year risk of the U.S. government. And so you know, I think there's certainly a secular issue that's out there. You know, it looks a lot like the end of World War II, as Russell Napier and many others have pointed out, where the only solution for the U.S. government will be ever greater levels of inflation to effectively reduce this absolutely insane amount of debt that it has incurred. And so I think we are certainly in a long-term, we have a long-term issue, and I don't see either party really reconciling with it, you know, post-November.
Then what's the trade? I mean, gold seems like an obvious one, but if we're facing both higher interest rates and higher inflation, the 70 shows that that leads to a collapse in kind of the equity risk premium and kind of equity prices. Higher interest rates collapse bonds. What do you do if you're kind of worried about this, and how do you position yourself?
Well, again, it's a question of really what tools do you have at your disposal? If I had all the tools possible at my disposal, I would own some form of yielding assets, right, that effectively are collateralized. But if I, you know, were a retail investor, et cetera, you know, I'd certainly look at owning property. Owning hard assets, owning gold. And, you know, I won't tell you owning Bitcoin because I still don't view it as anything other than a facilitator of fraud, which has a non-zero value, but I don't know if it's 70,000. But you're going to find ways to kind of get yourself out of exposure to the U.S. fiat.
U.S. fiat used to be called the Coca-Cola of monetary brands. What happened, Dan?
Well, ultimately, votes, you get votes by handing things out.
Yeah.
And
I've noticed that myself. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, ultimately, you know, there's extreme short-termism that, again, follows the incentive of how do I get elected? Yeah. Well, I take the cat, I clean out the cabinet of tomorrow's value and hand it out to everybody today and get elected and then let them suffer in the future. It's very irresponsible and it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Dan, one of your thesis at the March conference was that the huge everything bubble is going to lead to a series of imploding bubbles. What's the next thing to blow up that you're going to find opportunities to invest in? What are you looking, what's on your horizon?
Corporate. Where you saw the greatest number of bankruptcies last year that you had since 2010, and it's only escalated. And you're seeing that every day with increased numbers of restructurings and bankruptcies. And then beyond that, structured finance, credit cards, installment loans, auto loans, all of the things that have been securitized, you know, through the ABS markets are showing, virtually all are showing, you know, very material increases in delinquencies.
On the ABS side, a lot of the lenders out there are just saying that this is just a renormalization from COVID lows when everybody was getting stimulus checks and kind of defaults fell to all-time lows. Is there something kind of more to this than that? Because when I listen to what lenders say, they paint a more benign picture saying that we're just getting back to normal. And it sounds like you're expecting something that's not normal.
Well, yeah, well, I you know, we're seeing it, you know, in the subprime world, where there's been a series of different kind of bankruptcies and restructurings already. We're seeing it in, you know, we finance buyers of charged off consumer obligations. And the volume is increasing markedly. And the prices are reducing relative to the value that you can effectively derive by collecting on what are non-performing obligations. You can see it day to day where the amount of delinquency is increasing markedly. And so, you know, the numbers don't lie. You're seeing that delinquency data, and there's a lot of ability. And in fact, never has there been more ability for individual consumers to borrow from multiple parties that don't fully understand the presence of the other ones. And so people are getting more and more and more leverage.
How do you square on the one side, talking about numbers, the fact that you're seeing rising consumer delinquencies, rising corporate bankruptcies, and really good economic growth and employment growth?
Well, I think you're looking at greater levels of participation in the labor force by folks who otherwise are drawn into it because perhaps their personal balance sheet is getting more pressed. All right. And so what otherwise would have been folks who could have, basically subsisted on kind of support from the government are saying that's not sufficient to maintain a lifestyle. And so they're going to re-enter the workforce. We had incredibly low labor force participation, you know, going back 3-4 years. So I would assume we're seeing more and more of that because we're effectively folks are being forced to.
Dan, I'm going to conclude this conversation unilaterally by drawing a conclusion from something that I believe is your composite message, which is great country, bad balance sheet.
That's fair.
Okay. Dan Zwirn, what a pleasure it is to have you on the air, and best of luck to you in your unconstrained search for opportunity in places where people might be reluctant to tread. And so happy treading and profitable treading to you and your associates and your partners.
Thanks very much for having me, Jim. I appreciate it.
Dan, it has been a pure delight. Thank you again for being with us today. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. This is Jim Grant on behalf of Current Yield Grants, Interest Rate Observer of the Air.